Hello everyone and welcome to episode 607 of So You Want to Be a Writer, the podcast that's all about writing and publishing. My name's Valerie Koo. I'm CEO of the Australian Writers' Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses, and I'm your host. What has been happening in your world? There's been a lot going on in my world because I'm getting organised for the huge sale event that we've got happening at the Australian Writers' Centre. This is awesome. It's a massive sale event, and that is 40% off a huge range of writing courses. And this offer is available until midnight on Sunday, the 30th of June. So make sure you get in before then, because 40% off is huge. And it's something that we're doing to celebrate the end of financial year. I know it's weird to say celebrate the end of financial year, but I don't know. I have a thing about end of financial year. It probably comes from my days when I was an accountant, like decades ago. Lots of things happen to me at the end of financial year. So I actually really quite enjoy this time of year. So whether you are dreaming of penning your next great novel or becoming a freelance writer or just improving or just getting some confidence with your writing, there's going to be a course that's going to suit your goal. So find a course at the Australian Writers' Centre, because there's ones in creative writing, business writing, travel writing, everything. So we've got you covered. Check them out. The best part is that the courses that are on sale are self-paced, meaning you can learn at your own speed and on your own schedule. So whether you want to write about murder, if you're a crime writer with the wonderful presenter and best-selling number one New York Times best-selling author Candace Fox, there's that course. If you want to write middle grade and you want to write humorous stories for kids, there's Laugh Out Loud with Tim Harris. If you want to write chapter books, there's the wonderful course, Writing Chapter Books for 6 to 9-year-olds with Leslie Gibbs. I could go on, but I won't. Check it out yourself at writerscentre.com.au/sale. That's writerscentre.com.au/sale. And remember, that's up to 40% off. So check it out and don't miss out. And don't worry, if you're not quite ready to do the course at this exact moment in time because you've got a lot on, grab it anyway, because you have a full 12 months access to do the course. So I strongly recommend that you get it now. That's writerscentre.com.au/sale. And now let's welcome back Nat Newman, one of our wonderful creative writing tutors here at the Australian Writers' Centre, who also writes. She's an author, she's a freelancer, she's many, many things. Lately she's been getting into filmmaking and making short films. How are you, Nat? What's been happening?
Oh, I'm great, Valerie. What's been happening? I don't know. Lots of things. Lots of things.
Okay,
what's happening
good.
With you, actually? You always ask me and I never ask you. Is that rude?
That's okay. I tell people what's been happening anyways.
Yeah, that's true.
But what's been happening in my world? Oh my goodness, that's a very good question. I am learning Italian through Duolingo. I was learning Indonesian, and my friend, I don't know why it took someone to point this out. She said, "Are you going to Indonesia anytime soon?" And I said, "Oh, well, I have no plans." And she said, "Where are you going? Are you going somewhere?" And I said, "Oh, well, I'm going to Italy." And she goes, "Well, why don't you learn that?" And I was like, "Yeah, good point."
Yeah.
Okay. So, I've been doing that, which is really fun. And I just love how it's gamified and mm-hmm. You know, it's a little bit, it's like at those poker machines, right? The noises that it makes, and you chase the sort of mini dopamine hit when you say the words correctly or when you've done enough exercises. But So I've been doing that to amuse myself. There you go.
I'm the opposite when it comes to learning languages, or for a lot of things. I don't like things that are gamified. I do use Duolingo for my Swedish. But I have all the sounds turned off. I don't even look at the leaderboards. I don't collect the gems. I don't go for streaks. All of that stuff just annoys me so much.
Why would you not collect the gems?
Well, I mean, obviously, I collect the gems, but I don't do anything with them. They're just sitting there in the corner collecting dust, I guess. I don't know. Like, I just kind of, yeah, I don't like gamified things.
Why?
I don't know. It's just maybe it's the poker machine element of it. I also dislike poker machines. It's why I cannot spend any time on TikTok. I've tried a couple times to get onto TikTok and I can't. My brain just goes, no, eject, eject, eject. And then I have to like uninstall it. I hate it so much.
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, I don't like poker machines either, but I guess this is my substitute. All right. So, what is your writing tip for us this week?
What's my writing tip? Oh yeah, meta language in dialogue. This is something that comes up a lot in our students, in not so much in creative writing stage one, but certainly in novel writing essentials, like students who are writing longer chunks. But when you have a great big chunk of dialogue, it's really important to show how people are saying things. And we call that meta language. So it's not just what they're saying, because if it's just words on a page, you don't, if that's all it is, it's just words on a page. And sometimes that's all you need. Like if it's a short conversation, particularly if you've set up the scene really well, then you can sort of imagine what's going on. But it can be really helpful, and it can not just to help you picture the scene, but it can tell you something about power dynamics and the thought processes of your characters if you have them actually doing things while they're having their conversation. Someone who reaches for their coffee, or someone who looks around the cafe or whatever, that can show that they're disengaged from the conversation. Whereas someone who, takes off their glasses and peers at you intently, well, then that shows that they're about to say something quite serious. So do pay attention to your meta language in your dialogue. And one piece of advice I often give writers is, you often hear people say, listen to dialogue. So, sit in a cafe or sit in a train or whatever and actually listen to people speaking. But not only that, maybe sometimes don't even listen to what they're saying, just observe how they're saying it and see how that changes their intentions and how that, because some one person could, you could have one sentence, right? And you could have five people saying it in five completely different ways. And each one is going to have different meaning based on how they're saying it and what they're doing as they say it. So watch out for that. If you are, if you feel like, if you're too nervous to go sit in a cafe and watch people, which I completely understand, like you don't want the police
Why would
to
anyone
come
be
in.
nervous to sit in the cafe?
Oh, I mean, like the idea of like eavesdropping, I think, kind of makes some people really uncomfortable. Obviously, as writers,
Really?
yeah, yes, Valerie.
I
Some
must be a
people,
natural
you
eavesdropper
are
then.
a natural eavesdropper. That's why you were, that's how you, why you got into writing.
Oh
But for some
my
people, it does make them uncomfortable, which I think is really valid. Particularly, I think, like let's say, for example, you're a big guy or something, and you're standing there, you're sitting there, and you're watching a couple of young women talking or something. You got, unfortunately, that's going to make you uncomfortable, and it, could make you, it could make other people uncomfortable as well. So, if you don't want to observe other people, then the other thing I re really recommend is watching dialogue-heavy movies. So something like Glengarry Glen Ross, where it's lots of people talking and there's just so much talking. It's a bunch of dudes in a room talking, 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 talking. And if you just read the script, it's loads and loads of talking. But when you watch the movie, what sets it apart? And I know it's visual, but what sets it apart is, Alec Baldwin walks across the room as he says something. Someone moves towards a coffee machine. Someone picks up a glass. Someone, puts their glasses on and off. Someone shuffles papers. Those sorts of things tell you so much about the power dynamics in that situation. Like if you stripped out the words, you would still understand what's going on there. So yeah, so watch dialogue heavy movies like that, I think, can be a really good way, and observe the meta language to observe, to figure out how to put that into your own writing.
Okay, interesting. I mean, I absolutely advocate that for sure. Watching dialogue heavy movies, I think you can learn a lot from that. I'm just wondering if I have any tips to help people feel comfortable eavesdropping, because I think that's such a useful thing. It's such a you learn so much about human behavior, you learn so much about different people's motivations. You learn so much about how to represent, as you say, dialogue and feeling and intention in a subtle way. And oh, like we went out for dinner the other night, and after the people in the table next to us left, I was saying, oh my God, and what about the thing with her boyfriend who she waits up for because he's got a shift at the bar, da, 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 and he's like, and my partner's like, I didn't hear any of that. I got her entire life story and what she wanted to do at uni and, you know, the entire migrant family backstory and everything, and managed to have a conversation with my partner during dinner. But I just think it's a natural thing. I mean, Helen Garner talks about how she walks around with a notebook and actually is on the bus or at the hospital waiting room or doctor's waiting room, or whatever, and will just write down snippets of dialogue or things that she's observed. And it's and I find that so useful. So are you uncomfortable when you eavesdrop?
No, but I'm very comfortable going places on my own as well. And I know lots of people
Yes.
aren't. Like, I'll sit in a cafe or a restaurant or wherever by myself without any problems. So, yeah, for some people where that already is a big step, then the idea of pulling out your notebook as well and writing in public, that can be a big step. And that fear of getting caught, I think, really does stop some people. So, yeah, like these are all valid concerns, but like a lot of things with writing, you kind of just got to suck it up and get over it, I guess.
Yeah, because I really do believe that eavesdropping for the purposes, not for any nefarious
Of
purpose,
course, yeah.
but for the purposes of becoming a better writer is such a great thing. I think I've been doing it forever.
Yeah.
All right.
Definitely,
Anyway.
definitely a skill worth learning.
Yes, great tips. Thank you so much, Nat, and we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Valerie.
Let's move on to our competition this week. I have an awesome book for you. This week, I'm giving away 3 copies of The Bookshop Woman by Nanako Hanada. The Bookshop Woman is a delightful and heartwarming memoir that intertwines a bookseller's journey of self-discovery and human connection through the lens of book recommendations, capturing the profound impact of literature on our lives. I thought it'd be perfect for this audience. I hope you like it. Anyway, here's the blurb. Nanako Hanada's life is in crisis. Recently separated from her husband, living in youth hostels and internet cafes, her work is going no better. Book sales at the eccentric Village Vanguard bookstore in Tokyo, which Nanako manages, are dwindling. Falling out of love in all aspects of her life, Nanako realizes how narrow her life has become, with no friends outside of her work colleagues and no hobbies apart from reading and arranging books. That's when Nanako, in a bid to inject some excitement into her life, joins a meetup site where people meet for 30-minute bursts to find romance, build a network, or just share ideas. She describes herself as a sexy bookseller who will give you a personalized book recommendation. In the year that follows, Nanako meets an eclectic range of strangers, some of whom want more than just a book. Others she became real friends with. Written with a subtle but sharp sense of humor, The Bookshop Woman is a heartwarming book about a bookseller's self-discovery. It offers a glimpse into bookselling in Japan and the quirky side of Tokyo and its people. Books, once again, offer inspiration and serve as channels for human communication. I just loved the sound of this book so much that I knew I had to bring it to you as a book giveaway. Just go to writercenter.com.au/win and follow the instructions. I've made it super easy for you to enter. Entries close on the 24th of June. That's writercenter.com.au/win. And now, are you ready for the word of the week? The word of the week is chatoyant. Chatoyant. That's chatoyant, chatoyant. This is such a great word. It sounds really cool, right? And I want everyone to start using it. Just kidding. Okay, so chatoyant is an adjective and it means changing in luster or color. It also refers to jewelry that reflects a single streak of light when it's been shaped and polished. But the reason I love this word is because it comes from the French chatoyer, which means to change luster, like a cat's eye from chat, you know, cat, French. Right, there you go, chatoyant. I love that word. I'm going to keep saying it, chatoyant. And that was the word of the week. Are you ready to tell your story in your own true voice? or discover new inspiration and direction in your writing. Dare to Dream is a course by internationally best-selling author Kate Forsyth. It will help you unlock the door to your subconscious and find joy, inspiration, vitality, and empowerment in telling your story. You'll discover new ways of thinking about writing and storytelling, and importantly, face your fears and unlock your full potential. Join Kate Forsyth in this unique writing course that will help you find your voice and tell your story. Find out more at writercentre.com.au/dream. Now let's move on. We're doing something a little bit different this week. We usually have a writer in residence, but this week we're having two writers in residence. So please join me in welcoming them. Today I'm talking to Pamela Freeman and Liz Anelli. So this is such a treat because together they have created the wonderful picture book, Seed to Sky, Life in the Daintree. Pamela is the author of this non-fiction picture book, which I have no doubt is going to garner a slew of awards. Her work ranges from picture books to young adult novels to adult novels. She's published more than 40 books and is one of the country's most experienced authors. Liz Anelli is the illustrator for Seed to Sky and is an experienced children's book illustrator, but also writes her own books. We are so lucky to be able to chat to both of them today. Thanks so much for joining us today, Liz and Pamela.
It's lovely to see you, Val.
Thank you.
This is such a treat to be able to get both of you on this episode because I want to talk about not only your latest collaboration, this fantastic picture book, Seed to Sky, but you have a long relationship, an author-illustrator kind of relationship, and I want to dive into that a little bit more. But first, let's start with the latest release, Seed to Sky. Can you tell us, maybe we'll start with you, Pamela, can you tell us what is it about?
It's Seed to Sky, Life in the Daintree. And so it's about the ecosystem of the Daintree rainforest. And we tell that story, the nonfiction picture book, we tell that story by following the growth of a tree over 200 years, from a seed all the way through to when it pushes out of the canopy at the top 200 years later.
Now, how did you come up with this idea? Was it you, Pamela, who thought of the initial premise?
Yes. So Liz and I had done two books previous to this, one about Lake Eyre, Kadithanda Lake Eyre, and one about Kakadu, the seasons of Kakadu, Dry to Dry, it's called. And I had been to the Daintree, and it's such an extraordinary place. And so when we were thinking about where we wanted to go next, what kind of ecosystem we might want to explore next, that was really obvious to me as the next one. It's the oldest forest on the planet.
So Liz, in terms of deciding on what to illustrate, when you got the manuscript, what goes through your head? In this particular instance, anyway, what went through your head when you were brainstorming what kind of images that you were going to do to accompany the text?
Well, I do a bit of background research, but I very much have to go to the place because, and especially as not being born in Australia myself, there are a lot of places that I haven't experienced. And for me as an illustrator, it's very much about the quality of light, the smell, the feel, the texture of a place as much as what individual species and landscapes look like. And with this particular book, I had to wait for COVID lockdown to end so that I could actually travel to Queensland, which took a very, very long time. So there was quite a lead-in time before I actually started working on it. But getting a sketchbook full of drawings and paintings and a whole load of photos is my starting point, yeah, for deciding what's going to go on what page.
So when you went there, though, when you go somewhere and you think, okay, I need to experience it, is there kind of some kind of system? Like, do you just go and just see what happens? Or do you go, I'm going to take photos of plants today and then I'm going to do this today? What actually happens?
No, because there's not much time to do this. You know, I had 5 days in northern Queensland in the middle of the rainy season. So, you know, kind of a little bit limited by that, but that's kind of good. because yes, you just quite serendipitous, just go and see what happens, what occurs to me. I do take tons of photos, but it's more about making sketches, even if they're totally soggy and the paint's run everywhere. I've experienced it. So I've gone through the motions of putting something down on paper that made sense to me at the time. Doesn't matter what the result looks like in the sketchbook. And that really helps when I come to make artwork.
And are you then just getting a feel for the place, or have you got the text, the actual manuscript in mind, thinking, oh, I might do that image for that scene?
Yeah, so at this point, the text was written. I mean, not the very final, because there's lots of that goes on there. But yes, so I had the text, and most importantly, I had a whole list of species that, I'd tick off. Well, I've seen this one, found out about that one. Yeah.
So, Pamela, can you give us a bit of a timeline from conception to the research to writing it, and then after that, looking at the roughs and the illustrations?
Sure. So a picture book like this typically will take 2 to 3 years. In this case, it took longer because of COVID. But the actual illustration part often takes about 18 months. And so the first step is for me to come up with an idea and to pitch that to my publisher. And they very nicely came back and said, that sounds like a great idea. One of the things I do when I'm pitching to a publisher is that I connect it to the national curriculum. So when you're talking about nonfiction children's books, you have to pick up where in the curriculum children would be using that book in school. And so for this book, I did a whole list of each year where each year might use this book in their curriculum. And then I did the pitch of the tree. Coming up with that idea was the hardest part for me because I did a lot of research first, just general kind of overall research to come up with that idea, even though I'd been there a couple of times. And each of the other books had been there'd been a story, a cycle story, Dry to Dry was about the cycle of the year. Desert Lake was the cycle of a salt lake. The water comes and then the water goes away. So I was looking for that thread that goes through the story. And I decided on this idea of a tree growing up because partly because the curriculum looks at layers in the rainforest. And I thought, oh, yeah, that's a really good idea. So I pitched it. They said yes to the proposal. That still has to go through acquisitions and all that kind of stuff, like a normal book. But they came back and said yes. And so then I did the deep dive into the research. And you do that, in collaboration a bit with Liz, because now we talk to each other. But that's quite unusual. Most authors and illustrators don't talk to each other in the process. And then I wrote the kind of semi-final text. And that gets sent to Liz, and that's the point at which she can pick up and start doing the work. And as I said, that could last anything up to 18 months. And then we and during that process, I get roughs and I comment on them. Typically with Liz, that comment is, oh my God, this is going to be so beautiful. But with other illustrators, it might be that's not quite my conception of the character, say in a fiction picture book, or it might be actually that in this kind of thing, sometimes it happens where you go, well, that species and that species can't be next to each other. They have different requirements, something like that. But mostly it's kind of like, oh gosh, this is so beautiful. And then Liz does the final artwork, and then it comes back to me for a major edit with the editor at the end. And so that's my last involvement, where we sat, the editor and I sat down and we took out everything we didn't need anymore. So sometimes in the first text, you put in stuff to guide the illustrator, but once the picture is there, you don't need those words anymore and you can just take those out. So we probably took out something like 20%, 25% of the text.
How many words is it and how many pages?
I don't know how many words it is now.
32 pages.
32 pages altogether. Mm-hmm.
It's quite text heavy for a picture book. I mean, a fiction book wouldn't have that many words in. I don't know. Do you know your word count?
It's typically a couple of thousand before it gets edited down. And in this particular type of book, this nature story book series, there are two types of text. There's the lyrical text that tells the story of the tree. And then on each page, there's scientific text that gives you more detail about specific species or specific life cycles. And that allows the book to be used in different ways with different age groups.
And that's always the biggest challenge for me, because there's quite often three blocks of text on a double page spread, which, you know, when you've got a very detailed book that covers lots of species, lots of patterns, lots of shapes, and I'm trying to also make quite a big tonal contrast, you know, to fit three readable panels of text in with all that is a big compositional challenge. And it goes through many, many redraws to get the thing, because it's got to flow right as well. You know, it's got to flow visually across the page, left to right, just the way as we read text.
Now, I think, Liz, that a lot of people will be very surprised and shocked to know that it could take 18 months, sometimes longer, but, you know, 18 months to produce. So can you tell us what goes into it that means that it takes that long?
Well, although Pamela does provide me with some of her kind of research notes, I have to then go off and do my own research. And things like, typically, you know, if there are different species included on one page, then I will, you know, find all the details about that living thing and sometimes cut it out of paper, actual size, so that I can position them against each other and go, well, this one's that big and this one's this big, you know. And as Pamela said, you know, things that might not occur naturally on the same plant or in the same area, you know, there's all that factual stuff. I need to choose a color palette that is true to what's happening to the non-fiction of the text, but is also very much, you know, a beautiful piece of artwork that is visually engaging and not overly complicated.
And not too green.
Yes.
In a rainforest. I know Liz struggled with the thing of everything's green, green and brown, that's all you got. So the way she brings colour and tone into the page is just extraordinary.
So lots of experiments with time of day, you know, angle, position, perspective. So drawing and redrawing the pages over and over again until I've got something that works. And then doing lots more research, sort of painting research, sitting there on YouTube videos and stopping them and drawing stuff and sending messages to scientists and asking them questions, because I do find that the internet isn't always accurate. Even if you put in the Latin name of an insect, it might not be the right one. So lots of checking and double checking, and then many months painting. And I paint things separately and then I orchestrate them in Photoshop. So that's, you know, for each double page spread, that's a few weeks of moving things around like a sort of jigsaw puzzle until they work.
And so people who are new to this world are introduced to the concept of roughs. What do your roughs look like and what are they for listeners who don't know?
I do them in pencil to start with, so pencil line, and then I will usually import that into Photoshop and add some tone, just in grey, no colour. And I will write around the outside of the roughs notes like what each creature is. Part of this is for myself because, you know, if you've got 10 butterflies on the page and I'm not an entomologist, then I'm going to forget which one is which. And I need to know that for when I paint them. And then, yes, I send the whole book like that to my editor at Walker Books. And then that gets conveyed on to Pamela.
So, Pamela, you've written non-fiction picture. Well, you've written every kind of book there is, right? But in the world of picture books, you've written non-fiction picture books and you've written fiction picture books. Mm. Obviously, apart from the fact that there's a difference of fiction and non-fiction, What differs in your approach in how you write the story?
The big difference is that I feel a great responsibility to present this extraordinary part of the world to kids. These are used primarily in primary school. So I feel a huge responsibility to get it right, because these are like textbooks, you know. They're used like a textbook. They're on a lot of curriculum, you know, now. And so I feel a huge responsibility to get it right, but not only right in the details, but also right in the sense of wonder about this place and the extraordinariness of what we're showing to the kids. I feel that I have it's like a sacred trust, you know. I do feel like, yeah, that it's much more, I feel much more responsible in these.
Can I jump in there? Because when I share this book with school visits, you know, with classes, I find very much that the thing that I think is an unspoken of skill that Pamela has is the ability to write the two dual texts in a way that work when you're reading to a class. You will have line breaks because you will stop to talk about the facts on the page and then continue the prose, and to be able to do that with sentences that make sense when you interrupt them is a huge skill, and is the one of the great successes of our books, I feel.
I never thought about that, but yeah, you have to be able to do that. Yeah,
you have to be able to stop and start. It's not a story that you go all the way. You can choose to read the story all the way through, but quite often teacher librarians and so forth will stop and talk about what's going on the page.
That's really interesting, because I don't think about that deliberately when I do it. But I am a mum, and I have read a huge number of picture books to my son when he was little. And I think there's a feel for that. There's a feel for that that you develop as a reader, perhaps more than even as a writer.
It is so much more complex than people realize, the world of picture books, especially nonfiction picture books, because often this is a child's first experience of this world, and it does need to be factual, because they're going to carry it with them for the rest of their lives, quite likely. So it is a big responsibility. I mean, and a bit stressful. But let's change to Liz. How long have you been doing art and illustration, and how did you get into it? And then how did you get into picture book illustrations specifically?
Oh, well, that's easy. I've been doing it forever. So I was fortunate, and when I left school, brought up in England, I went to art school, I did a foundation, then a three-year degree course, and specialised in graphic design and illustration. And one of my tutors on my course was a children's book illustrator. So for the last year of my degree, I was doing children's book projects. And then at my degree show, I got my book that I'd written and illustrated picked up by a publisher and published the next year. So that kind of...
She's a writer as well as an illustrator, which frankly, I don't care.
And then I continued doing all sorts of book illustration work and mainstream illustration, advertising, packaging, all that kind of stuff, editorial. Had children, did other things, and then came to Australia, and that was in 2012. And that was when I kind of took a step back and thought, you know, I've only ever had that one picture book published. I'd had work in like other picture books, but they weren't my own thing. And I thought, if I want to be a children's book writer and illustrator, then now's the time to just get on and do it. And going to a new country kind of in a way made it easier for me, because I had to start networking from the bottom up, and I had no other responsibilities because my children didn't come with us. We ran away from them. And yeah, I just got on with it and got lucky, I think. I put my work into
I don't think it was luck.
A conference and got picked up by Walker Books.
Yeah, I don't think it was luck. I remember my meeting with my publisher where Liz's name was put forward, and it had taken them a long time to find an illustrator for Dry to Dry, because Walker Books make beautiful books and they're very picky about who they get to illustrate them. And they like to match the illustrator to the work really well. And I remember that meeting where they showed me some work that Liz had done, and they were very excited at having found you, Liz.
And it was a very different
completely sort of, so different.
Our first book, Desert Lake, is about a place with, you know, books are very busy. Desert Lake is like almost an empty landscape, and all my picture books and work up to that point had been about very detailed human landscapes with buildings and trucks and, you know, all. And then Walker Book said, would you like to have a go at this one? And I remember the editor saying, you know, it's okay if you don't want to do it. We'll find you something different.
Well, the first one was
Desert Lake.
Desert Lake. You had not met at that point. No. So in Desert Lake, did you meet at all during the process?
No. Not until it was published. And I had an exhibition of my artwork in Newcastle at the Lovett Gallery, and I invited Pamela along, and we were signing books together, and that's the first time we met.
And oh, wonderful. I knew that that it was a very special collaboration. You know, Desert Lake is an extraordinary looking book. In fact, there's a page from it hanging above my desk right now, because it was so beautiful. And I really wanted to keep working with Liz, and so we talked about what we might do next. And I also wanted, typically what happens is, here's the text illustrated, is what the illustrators get. But it was clear to me that Liz had enormous talent in terms of the storytelling of the image. And so I wanted her to have a more say in what we...
I'm a firm believer that a picture book is like making a cake. You know, we all put ingredients in, and then something comes out at the end that isn't what any one person originally thought it was going to be.
That's right.
Yes, and it's a big mistake that people make, or big incorrect assumption that the illustrator takes the words and draws something to match the words. It's so much more than that. Yeah. So, Liz, on that, what goes through your head in deciding, how can I add to this text?
Well, that's it, because, you know, it's like being given somebody's baby to play with and bring up for a bit. You know, I go to the place. So with Desert Lake, our first book, I achieved an Australia Arts Council Award, which gave me enough money to be able to travel into the centre of Australia and spend a couple of weeks really absorbing the environment and going, oh, what's it about visually? And for me, that book was about texture, detailed texture in the small scale against a very vast landscape. And that kind of informed the kind of media and art techniques I might use. And it became quite experimental with, you know, some monoprinting and stuff
collage,
like that.
You're using collage and all sorts of stuff. So many different approaches to get the image at the end.
So I think illustrators would be interested to know, with that award, did you apply for the award specifically to go to the desert, specifically to research Desert Lake?
That's correct, yeah.
Wow, great. Now I'm going to ask this question separately, because you have different answers, because Pamela, I'm asking you as the writer, and Liz, I'm asking you from the point of view of the illustrator of this book. So Pamela, in terms of the relationship that you have with an illustrator, what do you want from them and what do you think you should be giving them?
Okay, that's interesting. I would say that it's quite different working with Liz than anybody else, in that it's far more collaborative. So typically you don't know your illustrator, or you...
Well, cast your mind back to before you became friends.
Okay, before we became friends. What again, different from fiction and nonfiction. So for nonfiction, I want accuracy. I'm giving information to children and I want them to be able to rely as soundly on the visual information as they can on the text. And in addition to that, obviously, I'm hoping for great composition and colour and it looking great and all of that kind of stuff. But for nonfiction, that baseline level of you can rely on this image to be true. For fiction, I want my characters to come across with the feeling that I have for them. And it's not necessarily about accuracy there. So if we take an example, Victor's Quest was illustrated by the great Kim Gamble, who, alas, is no longer with us. And when I first saw the illustrations, I was like, oh, that's nothing like my image of Victor. But then, because Victor in my head is very handsome and strong and tall and gorgeous, and Victor in the on the page is a little bit gawky and scrawny and not so, you know, like buff. But then I realized that Kim had drawn the inside of Victor, that this is the feeling of Victor for him, and it's absolutely the feeling of Victor for me. And even though part of my conception of the story was this kind of contrast between this outside presentation and what he was really like inside, I was happy to go with the inside look because I knew it would give the kids more of a feeling for what the character was like. So, yes, that's what I'm looking for from an illustrator of my fiction.
And with the illustrators, are you ever afraid to be a bit to provide too much instruction? Do you ever kind of pull yourself back?
This is where I don't ever give instruction to an illustrator.
Illustrators would ignore it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But I would feedback to the editor. And then the editor, and that means that I can be as honest as I like, you know. And even if I hate it, you know, I can be honest about that. Not that I've ever hated anything of Liz's, but I have had illustrators where I've gone, these two pages, the character looks completely different. What's going on? You know, and then the editor takes my feedback, adds their own to it and massages it to be something that's useful to the illustrator and feeds it back to them. So yeah, it doesn't happen quite that way.
You have to remember the editor's job is a very delicate catalyst.
Yeah.
And it's probably most of the time it's best to keep the author and the illustrator apart for their own good health.
Yeah.
And the not that we'd argue, but because the best outcome is a brilliant book.
A brilliant book.
And like I say, it is the thing is a book actually belongs to the child who reads it. It doesn't belong to any one of us who helped make it.
Yeah. And also the designer is important in there as well. I think people who think about picture books often think the illustrator is the book designer, but they're not. Sometimes they are. But in most cases, there's also a designer working on it, and they're important too. So, for example, in this series, they would decide the size of the text, the colour of the text, how it's placed on the page around the illustrations. So they have quite an important role to play.
So Liz, this question is to you as the illustrator. Mm-hmm. What do you dislike in an author-illustrator kind of relationship or collaboration? And what do you and what do you prefer?
Well, no illustrator wants to be told what to illustrate. Obviously, there is a big difference between fiction and nonfiction. And also some stories that, like, for example, Carol Wilkinson's 10-pound Pom was her story. And so it was relevant for her to tell me what colour her brother's hair was. You know, that's not telling an illustrator what to do. That's actually part of the fact, but it's not written in the text. But for the best part, I like authors to leave me to get on with what I've done and then to come back with constructive feedback at the right point. And be prepared to lose a few words, as we say, you know, if it's already been visualized, then it's not always necessary to say the words too, because that's the magic of picture books, is where the story takes on its own identity. It's neither the words nor the pictures, it's a mixture of the two.
And authors can get very princessy about their work, you know, and really go, oh no, I can't get rid of that phrase, I can't get rid of that sentence, you know, it's integral, da, 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 da. And with a picture book, you've got to put your ego aside.
Yeah. And go, I appreciate it. It's a huge trust that an author puts in an illustrator to you know, to hand the baton over and let us run with it. I'm at the moment illustrating my own book, and I find that comes with its own problems and issues, because I develop my story visually for a bit, and then I put the drawings aside and I do some writing for a bit, and now the two sort of build up together. But you know, there's almost too many decisions to make when you're author and illustrator of a book. I think it's going to take me a lot longer to do this one.
It's interesting.
Liz, what would your advice be to illustrators who are doing fine as illustrators, but they want to get into illustrating picture books?
Oh, I think you've got to do some kind of writing course, you know, like a picture book writing course, because you need to know the nuts and bolts of how they, even if you think you know, because you've been illustrating and you've made story arcs all your working life, but it's not quite the same as writing them. Yeah, do a course and then join a writing group, a critique group, and keep going. And
what if you want to be just the illustrator?
Sorry?
What if you want to be just the illustrator?
Oh, that's probably easier in a way, but then there's more people who want to illustrate books. Putting your work out in front of publishers by joining organisations that have conferences, and you can do, you know, quite often at a conference you can do a one-to-one review. You know, you can sign up, you pay money, but, you know, you sign up and you get someone look through your portfolio and will give you feedback, critique, and hopefully they'll go, that's beautiful. We need to use you for a book.
You should probably mention Squibby here, the Society.
That's what I'm saying, yeah. Squibby, CBCA, they're all these kind of organisations.
Okay. People won't know Squibby, what that's.
So it's the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. So it's an American-based organisation that is all over the world. Every country has a chapter. I now belong to the Great British chapter, not the Australian one, but I do read the newsletters for the Australian one as well.
Pamela, have you got the next idea for your picture book brewing?
We just come back from the Great Barrier Reef, where we were doing the research for the next one.
Oh, yeah, is that why you were there?
That's why we were there. We were there last week.
Okay.
It's a hard life, very, very hard life. We go out snorkeling on the Great Barrier Reef.
When you have to go snorkeling for a day.
So it will be, it's called A Year on the Reef, A World in Motion.
So you've thought of the story arc in that already?
I did a lot of research to start with, and then my initial talks with the publisher, they thought a month on the reef would be quite good. But after I did my research, I realised that too many interesting things only happened once a year. And so I've recast it as A Year on the Reef. I had done a basic outline of what happens in each month. And then Lisa and I went up there and did, you know, solid week's research, including underwater. And what I was searching for was the sort of thing Liz was talking about, the feeling and, you know, what sense are we trying to give to the kids about the place. And what I came back with was the idea of a world in motion. Nothing is still. Everything is always.
We did both get a bit seasick, didn't we?
We did both get a bit seasick, but that wasn't quite. It was the spaghetti coral moving in the current was the thing that really clarified it for me. You know, the tide goes in and out, the wind on the water, the current underneath fish have to keep moving to get water through their gills. So it's this sense of ceaseless motion that is going to be the theme of the book.
Now, I want to talk about, because Liz mentioned earlier about doing school visits and talking to kids. And I come across a number of aspiring children's authors who love kids, love writing for kids, but could not think of anything worse than having than going to do school visits.
Well, they don't have to do it.
They don't have to do it.
Not everybody has to do it.
No.
My question then is, how often do you guys do it and why do you do it? So maybe we'll start with you, Liz.
I do love interacting with children, and I particularly love the fact that I do a little bit of talking and I show a couple of slides, but mostly I will spend 40 minutes drawing with, say, 60, 120, maybe more children. And I love the fact that after we've drawn together, and they're not slavishly copying what I do, you know, they're interpretive, what we're making a picture of. And so many of their teachers will say, utter surprise at the fact that this particular student applied themselves and had a beautiful result, which they wouldn't have expected. And I feel I brought something new to their curriculum that they might not get in mainstream education.
And how often would you do it?
It's like getting a peripatetic music teacher in who's like particularly good at the violin or something coming in.
How frequently do you do it?
Well, when I lived here, I used to do it for the whole of book week and then other occasions. Sadly, I have to say that in the UK, we're not quite so financially well off in the education system, and you're more likely to get a round of applause and a thank you rather than be paid to go into a school. So it kind of curtails, like, you're not so likely to travel. Like, I will go into local schools, but I'm not going to spend weeks and weeks doing it for zero remuneration.
Okay, how about you, Pamela?
Well, I do less than I used to before I started working for you, Val. I used to do quite a lot, because when you're making the transition from your day job to being a full-time writer, children's writers do have an advantage over other writers in that they can supplement their income by doing school visits. And the Australian Society of Authors sets rates for that, which are not overly generous, but which are okay. Mm-hmm. And so that's why you'll find that more children's writers can be full-time writers. And particularly because Book Week is so big here. And so typically I would be booked out for August, pretty much, when I was doing it more regularly. Now I tend to do it mostly when a book comes out or when a school I've got a particular relationship asks me. And I kind of feel like maybe I should be doing more of it, but it's hard. It's hard to juggle all the teaching and the writing and the and school visits. But yeah, what I would say is that there are many, many writers who like to have a day job. And for them, you know, they don't need to do the school visits, but they probably are more likely to be active on social media or something like that and make videos that schools can use and that sort of thing.
Absolutely, because that's what I was going to say, it's not for everyone. An in-person school presentation is actually really for people who like to be on a stage. You do have to perform, you know, you've got to entertain these children and keep them occupied and talking and drawing at the same time and keeping an eye on the time and all that. It's quite a demanding few hours of your life, but I actually love doing that because, you know, there's a little bit of me that's a bit of a show off and likes to get on stage. But I totally get that not everybody would be their cup of tea.
I love that getting the feedback from the kids, because kids are so honest about your work, and you'll get one kid going, I love this book, it's my favorite book ever, and then you'll get the next kid going, it was stupid. She was stupid. And that's a great opportunity to go, okay, tell me, why was she stupid? Tell me what was stupid about her. Yeah. And getting that feedback is priceless.
Yeah. But I think the top thing for me is that I never met any children's book writers nor illustrators until I was a grown up. And I would have loved to have had a writer and or illustrator come into my school when I was a child, it would have so boosted my confidence and everything else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Pamela and Liz, I could talk to you guys for hours because you have such a wealth of wisdom and experience between you both. Let's end with, we'll start with you, Pamela. Let's end with, why do you, what do you, I know you write for all ages, including yeah. many, many books for adults, but specifically writing for children. What do you enjoy most? What's the best thing about writing for children?
I get to do stuff I would have loved to have done as a kid. You know, so I get to make up the stories I wanted as a child and couldn't find. I get to have the experience. I'm basically 8 years old when I write. 8 to 12 is my age group mainly. And I have the boredom threshold of an 8 year old. And I think that's what I love the most is the you play, it's all play. And yet that doesn't mean it's not a lot of hard work, particularly if you're writing a children's novel. But yeah, you get to do the stuff you wish you could have done when you were eight, you know, go to the Great Barrier Reef or think about magic or whatever it is. I just want to say one thing before we finish to those people out there who want to write picture books. Please don't get your friend to illustrate them.
Yep. Without a doubt.
It's very, very unlikely that both of you will be so good that they will want you.
And both. They want you both.
Yeah.
And that's right. Or even that you'll be suited, that your friend's illustration style will be suited to that particular story.
And they also like to put a new writer with an experienced illustrator so that there's at least one name on the cover that the librarians know. So don't think you've got a better chance of being accepted if you have your book illustrated yourself, because it really reduces your chance of being accepted.
That is really, really good advice. And it's so important because a lot of people think that, their mum or their best friend can draw pictures and that they should pitch a book together, but it's not a good idea because, as you say, it's the editor and publisher who knows the ideal illustrator for your story. So thanks for bringing that up, Pamela. So, Liz, before I ask you what's the best thing about being a children's author and illustrator, what's your inside age? I'm curious to know.
Probably about 8.
As well.
Yeah, I reckon. I mean, that's the age that most of my memories are at. Well, between 6 and 8, I'm very much, you know, like I still believe I could fly if I flap my hands hard enough. I really think I could do it.
Nothing is beyond you, Liz. I believe it too.
I'll do it one day. It's the what would happen if, you know, like taking a line or a word or an idea for a ride and see where you go with it. I love that. And I absolutely adore the smell of pencil lead.
Oh, okay. So that's your answer to what's the most enjoyable thing about being a children's author and illustrator, like that what would happen if. I love that.
Yeah, but the illustration bit, I guess also that when you're in the flow of, say, drawing roughs, which is the most easy part because there's no pressure, you're just exploring, is actually looking down and seeing lines come out of the end of your pencil that you didn't kind of put there.
That happens in writing too. When you're in the flow with writing, characters do things you weren't expecting. Things happen.
Yeah.
And then you look and you go,
oh, that's all right.
Yeah.
I love that. Chasing the elusive flow, magical flow. I love that. Look, thank you so much, Liz and Pamela. Everyone, go get Seed to Sky. It's, you know, these two are masters of their craft. So if you want to learn how to write and create and produce an amazing picture book, absolutely look at the stuff that Pamela Freeman and Liz Anelli do. Thank you so much, guys, for your time today.
Thank you
for having us.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with the wonderful Pamela Freeman and the equally wonderful Liz Anelli. Now, before I leave you, I want to give you this fun fact. I was thinking about strawberries recently, and I wondered why they're called strawberries when they're not straw-coloured. You know, like blueberries are actually blue. There's no certain reason how strawberries came to be named, but one theory is that the straw actually comes from the little seeds on the outside, which kind of look like chaff, which is, you know, the dry stuff left over after you thresh straw. So there you go, strawberries. We're not sure where it came from, but I still love eating them. Thanks so much for joining me, and I really appreciate you hanging out, listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed bringing it to you. Please do connect with me on social media. I'm at Valerie Koo on Twitter and Instagram, and I'm over at valeriekoo.com. But more importantly, join the listener community on Facebook, because there's a bunch of stuff that happens in the Facebook group which is exclusive to that group. Sometimes I put giveaways in there and little surprises and Easter eggs. So just go to Facebook and search for So You Want to Be a Writer podcast community and request to join. And of course, if you would like to write your very own picture book, just like Pamela and Liz, then you might enjoy this course. This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. If you'd love to create your own picture book, a popular 5-week course in writing picture books will show you how. In less than a few hours a week, you'll discover what you need to know about point of view in a picture book, structure and pace, as well as language and rhythm, finding the right voice, working with illustrators, publishing options, and much more. Complete it online for ultimate convenience and receive personalised tutor feedback on your writing. Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/picturebooks.